I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of June. Our guest this hour is a pioneer in the field of injury epidemiology and the prevention of firearm violence, which results in 30,000 deaths each year in this country and approximately 75,000 non-fatal injuries seen in hospital emergency departments. In the 1980s, Dr. Garen Wintemute was among the first to look at the problem of guns and violence as a public health issue, and he has produced a large body of research on firearm violence. He's testified before Congress, the California legislature, served as a consultant for the National Institute of Justice, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He's a professor of emergency medicine, director of the UC Davis Violence Prevention Research Program, emergency medicine physician at the UC Davis Medical Center, which is one of the busiest trauma centers in the country. We have a lot to talk about this hour. There has been very little money that has been allocated to a study of violence prevention, and he is one of the few doctors really in the whole country. There are about six doing this kind of important work. We'll find out why during the course of this hour. And we will welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dr. Garen Wintemute, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I understand that you delved into gun research in the 1980s. Was there a reason that you did that? Was there an incident? Did something happen that made you say, I got to study this?
There wasn't a particular case. I was in public health school at the time and had been practicing emergency medicine before that. And from both those exposures, recognized that this was a very large problem to which relatively little attention was being paid, and that sounded like a good opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And what's amazing to me is, considering how large a public health issue this is in the country, you are one of a handful of people doing significant research. Why is that?
You know, it's probably unique in the discrepancy between the size of the problem and the amount of resources that are being devoted to prevention. It was true in the 80s, and it's true again today, that to work on this in this field as a researcher, one has to assume there won't be any funding for the research by and large, that the work will be controversial, sometimes risky, and lots of people turn away from a set of circumstances like that.
Mm-hmm. You, I understand, have put $1.1 million of your own money into all of this so that your research can continue. That's quite amazing.
That's correct. It's been over some years. I made a decision that the kind of work that we and others do is as important as work that's done on cancer and heart disease and so on. And if the way to keep researchers working and the lights on was to pay for it myself, I would do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's delve into some of the research you've done. And I was interested, I read a magazine, several magazine articles about you, that you started, evidently, you went to many gun shows, immersed yourself in the gun culture back in the 1980s. You joined the NRA. You started to visit gun shows. And the first show was in Milwaukee, which is where I'm sitting right now. And you saw signs that were used to advertise guns that caught your attention. One with, I don't know what these are, a Mossberg Model 500 shotgun with a pistol grip next to a poster that read, "Great for urban hunting." Another beside a Savage rifle, "Great for ghetto cruisers." That's pretty astounding. I would assume that we wouldn't see those kinds of posters anymore, but you must have been appalled.
I don't think it's a safe assumption.
Really?
We wouldn't see those posters anymore. And I recall the table at that gun show, next to the sign for that Mossberg shotgun, was a stack of shotgun shells sold for ammunition. And the little sign next to the ammunition said that those shells were loaded with double-aught buckwheat shot.
Oh, my.
It's that piece of work is sort of an example of what the field had to offer and still does. There were stories that needed to be told. I started going to gun shows out of a sense that they were a part of a larger problem, and as a researcher, devised a way to start collecting some systematic data. There came a time when I realized nobody will believe this if I don't have pictures, so I started carrying a camera. And ended up publishing a report about it that's available at our website and publishing some scientific articles as well.
Mm-hmm. You also did a landmark report on the gun industry in 94, and you were looking at weapons. You identified a small family of manufacturers in the L.A. area that produced cheap guns used in thousands of firearm crimes each year, and your research led to all but one of those being shut down, right?
It played a part. The guns that those companies made are still collectively known as Saturday Night Specials. From a violence prevention point of view, the circumstances were actually quite favorable. The vast majority of Saturday Night Specials in the country were made by one of these companies, and they were all in the same part of the same state, which meant that if the state changed its law, there would be national implications. And we did some of the same kind of work in a sense that we did at gun shows, did field work and combined that with data about the use of the guns in crime. And yes, that report was used first by some city councils and then eventually played a role as the state legislature went on to, in essence, ban the production of that type of firearm.
Mm-hmm. I know some of the research that you're doing now, and I'd like to talk about this in some detail, is denying firearm purchases by high-risk individuals and determining how it significantly reduces their risk of committing violent crimes. How do you identify high-risk individuals?
Well, the easiest way is that the law defines it for us in some cases. So under federal law, which applies in Wisconsin and California and everywhere else, you can't buy or have firearms if you've been convicted of a felony, for example, or a violent misdemeanor if the violence is domestic violence, not violence of other types, or if you're under a domestic violence restraining order, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So the law defines it. And what we have done is, in a couple of cases, looked at the application of that law and found that for those people who are directly affected, it probably reduces the risk of committing violent crime in the future by on the order of 25% to 30%, which is a big difference.
In your recommendations, Nature magazine, I believe, put forward what you advocate in three steps. One of the steps, they say, is forbidding alcohol abusers and those convicted of violent misdemeanors from buying guns. What is the relationship between alcohol abuse and terribly improper use of a firearm?
It's really quite striking. Whether we're talking about acute intoxication or a prior history of alcohol abuse, such as manifested by having multiple convictions for DWI offenses, for example, people in either condition, acute or chronic alcohol abuse, are at substantially increased risk for committing violence in the future, whether we're talking about a violent crime or suicide. And I should mention that at least when we're talking about firearm deaths, there are on the order of 50% more suicides than homicides every year.
Mm-hmm.
And to go back, we know about alcohol abuse. This won't be a surprise, but that the, in essence, to put it in simple terms, the badder you were in the past, the more likely you are to be bad in the future, that there's what scientists call a dose response effect between the magnitude of the alcohol abuse in the past and risk of future violence. So there are some states that have on the books an additional prohibition for firearm purchases that applies to people with multiple DUI convictions in a specified period of time. California does that for people with violent misdemeanor convictions like assault and battery. And one of the studies that we did showing that that kind of the denial of purchases by high-risk persons works was done on people with violent misdemeanor convictions.
Hmm. And I know you were trying to get those who had abused alcohol. The legislature passed what you thought should have been passed, but the governor said there wasn't as direct a link as he would like to have seen, so he vetoed it. And you said, "All right, we're going to study the link and give you indisputable proof."
We're going to give you solid evidence. Proof requires an experiment, and there probably won't be an experiment done. But yes, the legislature, the first time the bill was introduced, the legislature passed it. The evidence that we had was, I think there's very compelling evidence that alcohol abuse is a risk factor for violence. We also have evidence that firearm owners are, as a group, more likely than other people to abuse alcohol. But what we don't have, and this goes back to your first point about how little research is done, what we don't have is specific evidence tying alcohol abuse among firearm owners to increased risk for future violence. The mm-hmm. governor was technically correct. And yes, my response to his point that we don't have the evidence was, okay, we're in the evidence business and we'll be back.
Mm-hmm. But you only have three people working with you.
That's true. But we got a grant in the intervening time. We've gotten a grant to do a study of exactly the kind I just mentioned. And this time a year from now, I suspect that we will have that evidence.
Mm. Tell me what it's like, Dr. Wintemute, to be working in an ER room and dealing with gun violence. It must be such a difficult thing to do.
You don't get used to it. And I think that's a good thing. But it, as a researcher, reminds me, frankly, why I'm doing the research, that this isn't an abstraction, that there are real people's lives destroyed by this. And for me as a clinician, it's very helpful to know that I can be involved in the bigger picture and not just working with people one at a time.
Mm-hmm. I know that one of the things that you believe should be done is that we need to, and I wonder how we do this, rewrite current federal restrictions on gun ownership to better capture people who are mentally ill and at risk of violence to themselves or others. We seem to have a very hard time doing that.
Yes, and we've done a terrible job of it in the past. The language under current federal law is this, that if you've been adjudicated as a mental defective, and that's a direct quote, or committed to a mental institution, another direct quote, then you are prohibited for life. That language was adopted in the 1960s. It probably reflects a 1940s understanding of mental illness. It's arcane. It's offensive. It doesn't work. What we know is this, that mental illness in and of itself accounts for a very, very small portion of serious violence in the United States, probably less than 5%,
mm-hmm.
all the terrible stories about mass shootings notwithstanding. The more powerful predictors of violence in the future are a history of violence in the past, a history of alcohol or other substance abuse in the past. Combine those things with mental illness, and future risk is very high. But one of the attractive features of enacting policy related to alcohol abuse is it's also a very good way to focus on the high-risk subset of people who have mental illness. But most people, even with serious mental illness, if they are taking their medicines, are either not at increased risk for violence at all, or are at an increase in risk that's so small that carefully conducted research doesn't always find it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how you identify these people and make sure they don't have firearms. It's just because it seems as though so many of these mass shootings that receive all the attention, and there are other kinds of shootings that should receive just as much, I think, sitting in the city of Milwaukee. But it's hard to, you look at the past and you think, well, you know, they didn't exhibit signs. They didn't really, weren't put into a facility of any kind. They legally bought these kinds of guns. It just seems to be a morass.
Morass implies hopelessness, and this is not a hopeless situation.
Mm.
So first, it's also important to keep in mind that mass shootings account for no more than 1% of all the gun deaths in the United States. At one point, I toted up the people who were killed at Columbine and Virginia Tech and Aurora and Oak Creek, there where you are, yeah, and Sandy Hook together. All of those people together account for roughly the number of people we lose every day to firearm violence in and out. And I'm with you. We need to focus on what occurs day to day out of the headlines. Having said that, how we identify high-risk people and so forth, there are some things that can be done. Here's something that's going on right now in California, for example. When someone becomes a prohibited person, they've just been released from the hospital after an emergency hospitalization for mental illness and violence, or they've just been convicted of a serious crime, the Justice Department here goes to its computerized archive of records related to handgun ownership and, beginning this year, rifle and shotgun ownership and some other databases. And it looks to see if this person who's just become prohibited from having guns bought guns legally in the past.
Mm.
And if so, they knock on the door.
Oh, they do?
Yep. It's been a pilot program for some years. It is right now, beginning earlier this year, rather, being scaled up to go into effect statewide. And basically the approach is going to be, sir or ma'am, hi, we're the cops. We're very sorry. We know you're in a tough spot, but you can't have those guns anymore, and you need to give them to us. The pilot program has intervened with about 10,000 people.
Oh, my goodness.
Recovered about 10,000 guns. Nothing bad has happened, and we hope to evaluate that program and see what its effect on future violence was.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And what about the work in the city of Milwaukee and in other big cities in this country, too? There seems to be a steady supply of very cheap guns and a lot of people getting caught in the crossfire. There was a horrendous story just in the last week and a half of a young girl who was at a playground and two guys, there were more people involved, but she got caught in the crossfire and she's struggling for her life. And you get these stories all the time of trying to reach a population that has guns and for some reason doesn't seem to be very aware of other people who are around them. I don't know if drugs are involved here, if it's a drug war, if they're high on drugs when this happens so they don't realize who's around them, but it's just horrible, and you have so many of these kinds of shootings. Many of them are fatal, and so many innocent people are at risk. How do you handle that kind of violence?
Yes. The situation varies from case to case and from city to city, but our group a couple years ago actually did a study of stray bullet shootings
around
the country.
Oh.
Yeah. And what we found was that, as you said, most of them are incidental to intentional violence. Right? We all are familiar with the euphemism collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
This is collateral damage. These people aren't targets, so they represent the population at large, not the demographic that we think of being involved in violence. Nearly a third of them are children. Almost half are female, and that's because they're not targets. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The way to prevent those shootings, those particular injuries and deaths, is to prevent the violence that leads to them. And there actually are, specifically for big cities like Milwaukee, there are strategies that have been shown in other cities, at any rate, to be effective and worth a try. The violence interruption intervention that was pioneered in Chicago is one possibility. The set of interventions that were pioneered in Boston is another. There are things that can be done, even at the local level, without changing state law, that have been shown to make a difference.
What about gun buyback programs? Are they effective?
Depends what you mean by effective. I used to be a complete skeptic. When gun buyback programs first became popular, it was relatively few guns were turned in compared to the number of guns in the city where the buyback was being held. But also, the guns tended to be not the sort of guns that are used in crime. They were old. They weren't broken. They were broken. Lots of stories about people turning in old guns, getting the cash, and buying new guns with them. But to their credit, the people who have implemented these programs listened to that sort of criticism from the research community. And buyback programs are different now. If you bring in a gun that's not of much value for criminal use, you won't get very much for it. If you bring in a recently manufactured AK or AR, an assault-type weapon, you'll get substantially more money. There was just a buyback in Los Angeles this past weekend, at which a substantial portion of the weapons were assault weapons. I don't think that buybacks, as we do them here in the United States, as opposed to something like what Australia did, where they, in essence, required an entire class of firearms to be turned in and paid for them, the kind of voluntary thing that we do will not lower crime rates. But it does have this function. It serves as a focus around which a community can mobilize and prove to itself that it can do something about the problem. And if that sort of mobilization doesn't end with buybacks and goes on to some of the broader sorts of programs that have been shown to work, then I think buybacks serve a valuable function.
We go to phone calls, and let me give you our phone number. We're talking this hour with Dr. Garen Wintemute. He's director of the UC Davis Violence Prevention Research Program. He's a professor of emergency medicine and is an emergency medicine physician. He's a pioneer in the field of injury epidemiology and the prevention of firearm violence. We have yet to talk about background checks for all U.S. gun sales, and he's done a lot of research in, as you can tell, every time we bring up something, he's done research on this aspect of gun violence and prevention and treating gun violence as a public health issue. And when you look at the number of deaths and the number of injuries because of firearms, it obviously is a huge public health story. However, there has been almost no money given to this kind of research, and the money that he used to have, federal money, has been cut off. So he does his work, important work, with his own money and also getting some foundation support. We will talk about background checks and whether or not he believes there should be background checks for all U.S. gun laws. What do you think about his comments, which I think are interesting, forbidding alcohol abusers and those convicted of violent misdemeanors from buying guns? And also what it is we can do, we've talked about this so many times before, to capture people who are mentally ill, at risk of violence to themselves or others, to keep them from having guns. What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. Here's our number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. I think, you know, one of the big questions of the hour is whether or not those who have been convicted, maybe two DUIs, should be prohibited from being able to buy a firearm, because there's a direct association between alcohol use and potential firearm violence. What do you think? What do you think about all that we're talking about? Let's go to Pete in Madison first. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question is, I heard your story about how the governor had vetoed the proposed legislation, and you said you would come back with evidence for that. My question is, if you knew what the – it sounds like you wrote the conclusion to the study before you did the study. It sounds like you had a viewpoint that you looked for evidence to back up. It doesn't sound like an open-minded inquiry into the, you know, what the, I forget what the exact topic was. It doesn't sound like an open-minded inquiry into that particular area. So if you bring a bias to your research, how can you assure the objectivity and the validity of your study if you're coming in with a particular point of view that you're advocating for, instead of looking at the data and see what it tells us.
Pete, that's a great comment or question, and I'm happy to address it. I have to admit that this is one of those times when I think I know what the outcome of the study will be. I frankly wish it were otherwise, but my fundamental commitment as a scientist is this, to study the data and report what the data show. Let me tell you how we're going to do the study. We are going to look at records for a whole bunch of people who legally purchased handguns in the past in California. And using those records, we are going to follow those people forward in time and see who commits crimes and who doesn't based on arrests and convictions. And we're going to know among those legal purchasers of handguns who had prior convictions for alcohol-related offenses and other kinds of crimes and who did not. And we will enter all that information into the computer, and we'll, in essence, ask this question of the computer. All other things being taken into account, are gun purchasers who've got prior convictions for alcohol-related crimes more likely than gun purchasers who don't to commit crimes later? Given all the evidence that there is about the association between a history of alcohol abuse and future violence, and given that I think gun owners are basically just like everybody else, I think we will probably find for gun owners, as has been found many, many times in other kinds of studies, that people with a past history of alcohol abuse are more likely to commit crimes later. But if the data tell me that that's wrong, that's what I will report.
Thank you very much, Pete, for the call. And you, I mean, you're a pretty fair-minded researcher. There have been other people who, other groups who have been working against certain kinds of firearms who've not been very happy with some of your findings, right?
Yes, I get in trouble with both sides. I frankly think that's part of a researcher's job. When we were doing the gun show study, I came to realize that gun shows were only a small part of a much larger problem, which we'll address when we talk about background checks.
Mm-hmm.
And that efforts to close the gun show loophole, as it was called, would probably have no effect. And I, based on the data, published that conclusion and got in all kinds of trouble with the so-called gun control lobby, which was at the time interested in legislation to close the gun show loophole. My job as a researcher is to tell the country what the data show, not to serve a legislative agenda.
Richard is next in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I think you almost answered my question for me. I live in Wisconsin, and we have a lot of drunk driving violations in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
We probably have more DWIs than any other state per capita. Has any link been shown, or a correlation at least, between drunk driving and drunk killing?
There is, off the top of my head, I don't recall that there is that specific association. What there is, and there are at a minimum dozens of studies showing this, an association between a past history of drunk driving, whether that's measured by arrests and convictions, or even by asking people, because people will tell you that they drive drunk, and risk for violent crime in the future, including the sort of serious violent crime that gets you into federal prison. So in a general sense, that association is, I think, beyond dispute. And you're right, Wisconsin is nationally famous for its rates of alcohol use.
Thank you very much. Let's get into the area of background checks. I believe it was Missouri you studied. They had universal background checks, and then they repealed them. Was that the state you studied?
That wasn't my study. That was a friend and colleague, Daniel Webster at Johns Hopkins. But yes, that's what they did, and he studied that, in essence, policy experiment and found some results.
Uh-huh. What are your thoughts about universal background checks? I read somewhere that you believe that, and tell me if this is accurate reporting or not on what your thoughts are, that there should be required background checks for all U.S. gun sales. What does your research say in that regard, and would you agree with that?
Yes. First, if I had to choose the one thing to do, it would be enact universal background checks. It works like this. If I buy a gun from a licensed retailer, I have to show identification. The retailer has to run a background check. I don't get the gun unless I pass the background check or a waiting period expires. And there's a permanent record. But I can buy that same gun in many states, including Wisconsin, from a private party and have no identification, no record keeping, no background check, just cash in a handshake and the gun is mine.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a law-abiding person with no criminal intent, that's convenient. But if I'm a prohibited person, or if I'm buying a gun with criminal intent and I don't want a paper trail, that's really my only option. And in the gun show work that we did, you can see those two systems of commerce operating essentially side by side, literally one table to the next at a show. And I have watched people come up to somebody selling guns, negotiate a purchase, and only at the end, when they're about ready to hand over cash, be handed some paperwork and realize they've been negotiating with a licensed retailer. And then they simply walk away.
Huh.
And they buy the gun from somebody else where there's no paperwork involved. So I think the piece of research to mention here is this. We did a survey of licensed retailers, and we asked them, do you think there ought to be universal background checks? And they said yes.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure that they feel uncomfortable if they're selling guns to many of them, to people who commit crimes with them. It doesn't do their business any good.
You know, it was interesting. We also in that survey asked these retailers various questions having to do with, have people tried to buy guns from you illegally? And something interesting that came out of the data was, the more exposure a retailer had with that sort of attempted illegal commerce, the more likely they were to support things like universal background checks. And I think the answer to the reason for that is this. They know that when they say no to somebody, that somebody is just going to go out and buy the gun from somebody else who will say yes, and they don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wintermute, what are your thoughts about how close we may be to enacting universal background checks? Is it just a pipe dream at this moment?
At the federal level?
Mm-hmm.
I don't like pipe dream because it's a serious proposal, and I don't want to demean it. I think there is zero chance of enacting universal background checks given the current makeup of Congress. It simply won't happen. For some time, we've been doing our work thinking it may be 10 or 20 years before people are ready to put this evidence into practice. But by golly, when people are finally ready to do something, let's have the evidence available for them. So we work with that sort of time horizon. At the state level, it is by no means a pipe dream. Six states enacted universal background checks in the last year.
Let's go to Jack in Racine. Hi.
Hi. I was really appalled and surprised at the lack of objectivity. I mean, a perfect example being the gun show problem. I attend many gun shows, and I've always been asked at the beginning of any type of negotiation whether or not I'm qualified to buy the gun legally. You know, the bias is just appalling.
Wait, you don't believe that our guest went to a gun show where it was easy to just buy a gun? You don't believe that didn't happen? You don't believe his word? You don't believe his word? You don't believe the word of our guest that happened? I mean, it's not a bias.
I didn't believe him. I just said the lack of objectivity was appalling. And please don't put words in my mouth.
Well, I'm trying to understand what you mean. What do you mean by lack of objectivity?
I do have a question to know if he owns a firearm. Doctor, do you own a firearm?
That's not a question that I answer, and let me tell you why. And I actually recommend that other people, by and large, don't answer that question either. Reporting that a person owns firearms substantially increases their risk for burglary because firearms are hot property. So I don't talk about what I have at home.
I do have one more question, and that has to do, how does firearm deaths or even injuries, for that matter, compare to traffic automobile deaths and injuries, with level playing field? I mean, there's a lot of people that drive. There's a lot of people with guns.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much for that, Jack. It is my very favorite question, and here's why. I'll shorten the answer. In the 1960s, we faced an epidemic, as it was called at the time, of deaths related to motor vehicle traffic. And we did what this country does best. We mobilized. We put top researchers on it to study what was causing the problem. Congress got into the act and said, tell us what the science is and we'll do something about it, with the result being that we have driven the motor vehicle death rate down by much more than 50%. With firearms, we did exactly the opposite. We've steadfastly refused to address the problem. And the result is that the lines, there used to be a huge difference between the number of motor vehicle deaths every year and the number of firearm-related deaths every year. And the result of that difference in approaches is that this year, these days, from one year to the next, we wait to see when's the year that firearms are going to take over. Mm-hmm. It may actually have happened in 2012. We
really?
Just don't have the data yet. Yeah.
Really? So can you explain to us why it is that we took action, because it was a public health issue with automobiles? It is in so many ways a public health issue with firearms as well, and yet we won't do it with firearms. Why?
So there are lots of answers that everybody always brings out, and all those answers are valid, that there's opposition not just from industry as there was from motor vehicles, but also from users of the product, and that wasn't such an issue with motor vehicles as it is with firearms. But one thing that I think deserves some extra emphasis, only because it's not mentioned much, is this. Nobody had trouble conceptually aggregating all the different kinds of motor vehicle-related deaths as motor vehicle-related deaths. People got it, that there was a common denominator. And with firearms, it's been a harder sell. It's still the case today that the discussion of firearm violence, for example, focuses almost exclusively on crime, even though there are 50% more gun suicides every year than gun homicides. We still tend to think about the crime problem and the mental health problem, and, oh, by the way, those accidental shootings over there, that's sports. But we've had a more difficult time keeping the common denominator, the misuse of a product, in front of us.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Dr. Garen Wintemute. He's director of the UC Davis Violence Prevention Research Program. He's a professor of emergency medicine. He is an emergency room physician, so he has seen people who have been victims of firearm violence, those who have died and those who have been injured. He works in the field and has since the 1980s of injury epidemiology, and the prevention of firearm violence has done a number of significant studies that we should say have been criticized sufficiently by those on one side of the issue or the other to prove that he is a looking at the facts, ma'am, kind of guy. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls. Christina in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Christina.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's one law in Wisconsin that we should support that would prevent gun violence, what it would be. And then also, besides the legislative component of this all to prevent gun violence, what other things can we as individuals do?
Thank you, Christina, for that. It's a tough choice. I am going to suggest that let me explain why it's a tough choice. This is a multifaceted problem. It varies from place to place. I know California better than Wisconsin, but I think across the board, In states that don't have it in place, the thing that's most important to do is to adopt comprehensive background checks. More than 90% of the general population supports this. More than 80% of gun owners, something like 70% of NRA members. There's almost nobody outside a few state legislatures and the leadership of some organizations opposed to it. It's a common sense idea that has been shown to work. So that's what I would put at the top of the list. Other than legislative things to do, I think local solutions need to be crafted for local problems. It's part of the tragedy of all the state preemption laws that they hamstring those sorts of efforts. But in the city of Milwaukee, for example, I might look at a couple of things. One is, where are the guns coming from? My understanding is that Milwaukee has had a number of celebrated cases or notorious cases involving guns brought in by small-time traffickers. Seems to me the city of the town of Wild Rose comes to mind as a very small town that turned out to be a leading source of crime guns in Milwaukee because of one person or one small group of people. Looking at where guns come from is one. Another one is to have a look at programs like Cure Violence, what used to be called Ceasefire in Chicago, the violence interruption programs, the sort of pulling levers approach in Boston, and see if those can be adapted to Milwaukee's conditions.
Could we go back? I know it was a few years ago, but I'm having a hard time understanding why anybody would want to be selling guns to people who they suspect. I would imagine, I mean, they're selling them cheaply and not in proper channels, that they may be used for some violent act. It must have been the case in Los Angeles when they closed down because so many of those guns were used in violent acts. Who are these people who are doing the selling of these guns?
Because they make money at it.
Wow.
I don't mean to be flip. I've talked to some. I have had conversations with the owner of one of the largest of the companies that was shut down. And he was very clear. He did not... I'll clean it up a little bit. He didn't give a damn about what happened with those guns once they left his plant. He made them. He made good money on them. And it's those particular guns. Part of their market segment was cheap guns. But it's you also mentioned in general why people sell guns to people who might commit crime. They don't necessarily get sold cheaply. That sort of privacy and discretion comes with a premium. And so, for example, guns that come to the upper Midwest, to Chicago and Milwaukee, travel to get there. People will go to places like Indiana or even Mississippi and acquire those guns at market rates in those states, but they sell them in places like Milwaukee at a markup, not just for the travel, but because here a purchaser who's acquiring a gun with criminal intent has, first off, it's a new gun, doesn't have any bodies on it, as they say. Mm-hmm. And number two, nobody knows he has it.
Hmm. Let's go to Randy in Chippewa Falls. Thank you, Christina, for your call. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Good afternoon, Doctor. I have a question or a comment, I guess maybe a little bit of both. First of all, I think it's great that you're doing that research, especially that given the fact that there is very little money funding it. I know that that's very difficult to do. You made a comment a little earlier in the program about motor vehicle traffic and in the 60s and how there was a response to improving accidents and such. Is that correct?
Yes.
It seems to me, and I could be wrong about this, but it seems to me that with respect to motor vehicle traffic, Americans are far more homogeneous. Most of us wind up driving at some point in our adulthood, and I think we all have a decided interest in reducing motor vehicle traffic accidents, whereas I would argue that alcohol, tobacco, firearms, you know, they've been in the American fabric since before the country was even founded. And there's a lot of heterogeneity among people with respect to those particular issues. It seems to me that you would always be in for a fight. if you're going to try to limit access to any of those, alcohol, tobacco, firearms. Somebody somewhere is going to want to fight with you about that.
Right. It's a really good observation. Here, let me walk out right out onto some thin ice and just observe that prohibition actually worked. That it created a black market and a terrible crime problem, but death rates from alcohol-related problems actually went down. But to go back to your motor vehicles point, it's a good point thoughtfully made. It turns out to have a problem, and here's the problem. When we started to address motor vehicle-related death and injury, the thinking was precisely that. They'll act in their own best interest. We can make people better drivers. We can teach them how to operate motor vehicles more safely and so on. And by and large, that approach failed. And what we learned the hard way we had to do instead was change the product so that we redesigned cars. We redesigned the roadway. We tried getting people to wear seatbelts voluntarily, and it didn't work. We tried to get them to obey the law, and people did, except for the young, the intoxicated, and the elderly, the people who were already at greatest risk for dying. We couldn't get the high-risk groups, so we put airbags in cars and protected everybody. It turned out that we needed a much broader mix of strategies than anybody thought was going to be necessary at the beginning. And I think that same thing applies to firearms. We need a mix of approaches, not just one.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Ben in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do have a question. First of all, I'd like to say I really appreciate the objectivity of the doctor. And that being said, it's hard for me to understand why he's saying that FFL dealers support universal background checks when they directly financially benefit from that. How does that jive with objectivity in studies?
So thank you very much for that. So I actually expected them to be opposed. And the reason for that is this, that in my conversations with FFLs and also, I'm sorry, for the listeners, FFL stands for Federal Firearms Licensee, a licensed retailer like a gun dealer or a pawn shop. And in reading the trade journals, what I mostly saw was, we don't want this extra paperwork. This is a big hassle. We'll never get reimbursed enough to make it worth our time. And we had a majority of at least the respondents in our survey supporting universal background checks, even though the talk within the industry was it's going to be a big hassle. There are comments from published from FFLs saying, look, we need to step up and do the right thing. There are others who point out, wait a minute, he might be just coming in to do some paperwork, but while he's in the store, he's looking around, and maybe I'm going to get a customer for accessories and ammunition. But on balance, here in California, for example, we have universal background checks. We've had them for more than 20 years, and dealers basically do not make money on it. If they get a return, it's in the customer coming back to buy other things.
Mm. And thank you very much for the call, Ben. Dr. Wintermute, thank you so much for being with us. Keep us informed of all of your latest research.
Thanks very much for having me.
I hope somebody gives you some money.
Me too. Thank you.
I'm sure you do, instead of $1.1 million of his own dollars. He's director of the UC Davis Violence Prevention Research Program. He's a professor of emergency medicine. He is an emergency room physician. He has been in the field of injury epidemiology and prevention of firearm violence for a long, long time now and has done a number of significant studies. Thanks to Marika Saval for producing this hour, and thanks to Marika Saval for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we'll move into another hour of conversation. I think we all think about getting out in the sun, but how good an idea is that? It's summertime, but skin cancer rates are just going through the roof. We'll find out why, what kinds of skin cancer, and how to prevent it. Hour 2.